Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show and happy Halloween, if you know what I'm saying. And I think you do. Today is October 25th. I'm just wishing you, happy holiday early to make sure you're ready. This is a holiday that requires a costume. It's a pretty serious event. You've been given notice. I am still shopping for mine. Is this what the show is about today, Brett? Absolutely not. I just want to get that out of the way. So anyway, listen, earlier this week, actually, I had a great discussion with a podcaster named Josh, who's the host of a very popular financial planning show called Radical Personal Finance. You can check out his site at radicalpersonalfinance.com. And he's currently doing a series on education. And he wanted me to come on and talk about the history of public schooling in America, its mission, and then get into solutions and alternatives. Our entire discussion was 2.5 hours. So all valuable stuff, I thought, especially as a primer or review. I decided to put it here because I think there's a lot of people who could benefit from this. Today's discussion is the history and mission. The next discussion will be solutions and alternatives. And we go off course a few times, but it's all good stuff and I left it in. Now, how did Joshua discover the show? Well, he said that he listens to David Allen, and David Allen had reposted a discussion that he had with Richard Grove on the Tragedy and Hope YouTube series, History So It Doesn't Repeat. Anyway, from there, he found the Peace Revolution podcast. He heard the name School Sucks thrown around a few times over there, and he found us and became a fan of the show. So I'm very happy to have Joshua on board, and I was really happy to be able to contribute to his series on education. And of course, what are you up to, Brett? Thanks for asking. Busy week next week. On Tuesday, I'm going to be on Red Ice Radio. That is a huge show. This could be a very good boost for us. I'm really, really excited. And I'm dusting off the old notes because I'm not sure what we're going to talk about yet, but I want to be ready. I want to be sharp for that one. And I love Red Ice Radio. Check out Red Ice Radio if you've never heard it before. They cover an array of very interesting topics. Next Saturday, which I believe is November 1st, I'm going to be in Keene at Keenevention. Isn't that an appropriate name for a convention held in Keene? Keenevention. I will be at 1:30 p.m. on Saturday, November 1st, appearing on a media panel to talk about my little podcast here. Mark Edge of Free Talk Live is hosting it. Stephanie Murphy will be there. We love Stephanie Murphy on School Sucks. She's been on the show a bunch of times in the past. I got to get her on again soon. Chris Cantwell, who we're really on the fence about at this point, aren't we? Who's this we you speak of, Brett? I'm not on any fence on that issue. But, I really look forward to that. I look forward to what all those people have to say about their media projects. And I look forward to rubbing elbows with the Keene elite at Keenevention. And if you're not too far away, come check us out. The riot is over. Come meet the folks. I went there last year. I had an awesome time. I thought Ian did a great job organizing this small event. And I think it'll be bigger this year. And I think it draws a lot of people from, New Hampshire and New England. So that's what's new with me. I've got more stuff to announce, but I'm going to hold off for now. That's enough things for you to scribble into your calendar for now. But stay tuned for more news. All right, here's my discussion with Josh from Radical Personal Finance. Part 1 of 2, you can expect the second part to show up, Monday or Tuesday. And I fast-forwarded through the parts you already know. Here you go, everyone. Have a great weekend.
So Brett, welcome to the Radical Personal Finance Podcast. I appreciate you being with me this morning.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So you're probably, I would bet this is probably your first time coming on a personal finance podcast to talk about education. Do you get a lot of calls from people to talk about finance and school at the same time?
It's my first time on a personal finance podcast ever.
Well, good. Well, I think we'll see as the interview goes on. I'm hoping to pull out some themes and to just basically use you as a resource of knowledge to share with me and teach me some things and teach the audience some things as well. So,
absolutely.
Here today to talk about school and education. And what I'd love to do is, would you start with maybe a little bit about your background and your path as a teacher, and then how you wound up hosting the School Sucks podcast?
Sure, absolutely.
What I decided to do is I was continuously learning my way out of jobs that I had. And I wasn't really, kind of taking a moral stand against the kind of work that I was doing. It's just like the more I learned about
And that was why I started the podcast in 2009.
need to hear your background, and I want to talk about what you cover with the podcast, but I want to give you just a little bit of introduction.
Sure.
Just to kind of how I came to learn a little bit more about the history of the school system.
Absolutely.
So I come from and this will help, I think, to also center the conversation for the audience. I come from a background of working as a professional financial advisor. Mm-hmm. So I'm young, I'm almost 30, and for the last 6 years, I worked as a full-time financial planner. And when I started working as a financial planner, I was young when I started. I was 23 when I started. And I had just a lot of very simple answers. I thought everything was essentially straightforward. After all, I had always been interested in personal finance. The rules of how to, you know, get wealthy and stay wealthy were fairly simple and fairly straightforward. And I figured all I needed to do was just simply teach people all the stuff that I had learned and that I had memorized, and everything would be simple. Then I actually started working as a financial advisor, and in working as a financial advisor, I started to experience that even though I might have had a technically correct answer, it didn't always work. Mm-hmm. And what I learned is that it just felt like, and I'm compressing a lot into a short period of time here, but it felt like a majority of the people that I was working with didn't, you know, everyone was kind of pursuing the same path, that they didn't actually understand why they wanted and why they cared. And it wasn't really working, but everybody felt like they should be doing something that they weren't doing. And so specifically, this is most apparent around the topic of retirement planning. Mm-hmm. When you ask over 1,000 people, you know, when do you want to retire, essentially, and a great majority of them tell you age of 65 or 60, and I'm looking at it, and then I ask why, and you find out there's really nothing behind that except that's what everyone else does. That really bothered me, because I looked at it, and I'm a pretty kind of, I think I'm a little bit of an out of the box thinker, and I say, why would you wait till 65? Why don't we do it other ways? So when I would start to describe other paths to people, other potential ways to achieve their financial goals more quickly, I'd often get a blank stare. And then I was frustrated that I didn't seem like anybody wanted to learn anything. And so through a variety of circumstances, that got me interested in saying, why? Like, what is wrong? Because why can I not get people to do these things that work more quickly? Why can't I get someone to leave a job and just go start a business? And that sent me through a series of interesting occurrences to studying the school system and learning about some of the history that I had never known. And so that's kind of how it connected to finance. And I bumbled into the history of schooling without any prior connection to it from a school perspective. I was bumbled into it trying to solve the problem in financial planning. And right. I was educated at home through seventh grade, and then I went to a private school through high school and then college and whatnot through a more traditional path. So I think I had some experience that made me more receptive than many people. But so that's just to give you some background as far as how I stumbled into thinking and talking about schooling.
Yeah, there's something you said too, though, that really, it made me think the attitudes of obedience and conformity that are just so prevalent in society. It was one word. And I'm not faulting anyone for this. I don't want to say that people are thoughtless about this, because it sounds so crass. But like, I just don't think people have ever really been given opportunities in some cases to think about these things. And retirement, like when I hear somebody say that word, I have so many questions. Like, what is retirement mean to you? I mean, mm-hmm. I think now about how I spend 30 to 50 hours of my week, and I wouldn't want to not do that. Is it like relief from doing that thing? Do you sit on the beach? Do you join a shuffleboard league? Like, what does it mean? What do you do with all your time? So even the idea of retirement kind of leads me to the question of, what are you doing in life? Do you want relief from that? Are you deferring happiness that you could have now some way? Right. Just with this end date in mind that I guess was kind of, I don't want to say it was arbitrarily set by the government at 65, but are people just kind of like fighting their way through life to get to that point when they can do what? Nothing? I have so many questions about that, but I think it kind of lines up nicely with what you were saying, that people would give you this answer of 65 just because that's like a set retirement age and that's right. When it will be over.
Right. And I've done a lot of history. I've done a lot of, as much studying as I've been able to find mm-hmm. to find out about the history of retirement as a word and as a concept. And mm-hmm. I've got a couple of shows where I talk about the history a little bit that you might be interested in afterward with some of what I've learned on the subject. But I really feel like you hit the nail on the head. And what I observed is in a simple example, that you make the point of, okay, you can just simply transition from, why not create something that you wouldn't want to quit from? And this is what I learned in doing financial planning. I learned, once I learned all the science of it, and I took away the whole like idea of retirement that I've got to do this for these benefits. And once I learned about benefits and learned about tax and all the mystery went away, then I said, there's a simple and easy way to retire. You know, pick a job that you wouldn't want to retire from and go do it. But I couldn't get, I struggle to get people to A, figure out what they want to do. And I think this has a lot to do with schooling, which is where I want to go to, is that I feel like A, people don't, even me, I'm not that in touch with what I actually want to do because I'm not accustomed to thinking about what I want to do. I'm accustomed to simply doing what I'm told to do that I need to do. And then B, helping people to have the courage to just make the jump out of what seems to be safe and secure into what seems to be scary. And those are the two things with financial planning that seem to be the two biggest obstacles. Number one, not knowing what we want. And number two, having the fear of going after it.
Right.
So I've been trying to figure out why. Like, why psychologically do we face this fear? And I think part of it might have something to do with schooling. So you reached the conclusion that school doesn't work. Why did you reach that conclusion and how?
Well, first of all, it depends on, does the school work? It depends on who you ask. You know, I mean, I would think that the average politician, if you could get them alone in a room and get them to be honest, you know, somebody running for office, like on a national level, they would say, oh man, school is awesome. You know, nobody has any critical questions. You know, look at the media, look at what people are ingesting and calling the news. I think that there's obviously, you know, I don't want to get down on like marketing or advertising. I think there are obviously, you know, important functions in a free market economy. But in my opinion, those people should have to work a little harder, you know, to win people over. There is an uncritical nature of adults on certain issues, even people who are very, very smart. People who have skills that I'm just always impressed by. I remember having political arguments with a dentist, you know, and a brilliant man in some respects, but his attitudes politically, I was just like, you know, you're allowed to put a drill in a person's mouth, you know, with this kind of thinking. And so the compartmentalization of knowledge or lack thereof is very interesting. And I think for pupils and for parents, we could say that the schools aren't working. But there is, you know, certain corporate interests or government interests or even academic interests that really, I would say, if you could get those people to be honest, they like what the schools are doing. I would say the schools don't work because they teach three primary hidden lessons. The first one I already mentioned was obedience. The second, conformity. And as a result of those two lessons, I think you get kind of an intellectual apathy. You know, like if you're obeying and conforming, that leads to obviously a lack of energy when it comes to thinking. There's not a lot of thinking required in obedience and conformity. So, I mean, I would say in that respect, the schools do not work. And, you know, largely that's by design. I think sometimes if I talk about it in too shorthand a way, it sounds like an evil plan. But it really wasn't. It was, you know, the misguided good intentions in a lot of cases that paved this road to hell. And, you know, it's a long story. I wanted to ask you how much time you wanted to spend on the history of school. Did you want a 5-minute version, a 10-minute version? What were you thinking? Because
I want to give it it can't be as long as Underground History of American Education.
No.
But otherwise we'd be here for about 50 hours.
Right.
But I don't want to give it a 5-minute version because this is an aspect of history that I'm fascinated with. Mm-hmm. And what's so interesting is that I was always excellent at history as far as passing the test. You know, I got a 5 on my AP US history exam and I knew how to study, but I always hated it. And then I became an adult and I started studying like a little bit of history of things that I cared about. And now I'm essentially obsessed with history because if I can understand the history of something, then that allows me to understand a little bit more about like how that allows me to understand the present with a little bit more of a clearer lens on what's actually happening. So
absolutely. Yeah.
Let's trace through the history of the school system and we could take as much time as we need. How did we get to where we are today?
Sure. Well, on my show, in most of my narratives about this, we're usually starting the story of public schooling in the Kingdom of Prussia, which was in Central Europe, where Germany is today, usually in the 1810s, or sometimes we can start the story in the United States in the 1840s, or really the 1850s, where that Prussian system was spread. Now, before I go into that in any detail, I think it's worth pointing out that the concept of education as a public good on a national scale predates both of those periods. I mean, there's legislation and government action regarding the idea of education as a public good all the way back into the 1780s. And there's something called the Northwest Ordinance, where there was basically requirements for systems of public schooling to be set up every time a new township was established. And this also included, like, how do we raise money through taxes? And how is land allocated for this purpose? And into the 19th century, there was more legislation regarding land grants for not just public schools, but also colleges. And all the way into like the 1860s during the Civil War, when they're talking about, specific purposes of teaching, agriculture, mechanical arts, industrial education, things like that. Now, the interesting thing is that nowhere in the U.S. Constitution, which is allegedly, I'm told it's supposed to be like the guiding document of the United States government, is there any mention of education as a public good on a national scale. Therefore, it should be a state's issue, according to the 10th Amendment, that all the powers that are not explained as, a role of the federal government are left to the states. For some time, that was the case, even when a lot of academics and intellectuals started to have designs for national schooling or even a national curriculum, which is a very old idea that's still being pushed today. The education was really up to the states. And of course, even today, education is funded to a large degree on a local level, even though it is controlled to a large degree on the federal level. And I think one of the important changes in this was in the 1860s, there was the 14th Amendment. Right after the Civil War, and basically what the 14th Amendment does is it guarantees rights to all citizens. And there's certainly a lot of questions in that statement, but the actual text is something like anybody who's born in the United States or becomes a naturalized citizen, no state can make any laws that deny them the privileges or immunities or protections under the United States. So in other words, and what's kind of sneaky here is that everybody is now not a citizen of their state, but a citizen of the United States. And the federal government, because of this, sees or people working within the federal government or people working around the federal government see the federal government as having all kinds of new responsibilities to its citizens. All documentation regarding the United States prior to the Civil War was written as the United States are. After the Civil War, it's the United States is. That was one very important piece of the history, right? That with the 14th Amendment and everyone becoming kind of wards of the federal government, then you see that there's more of an impetus for a national plan of education as a public good or as a public service. And there's other angles that we can pursue this from as well. It's not as simple as just shifting to the state as a form of control. There's all of these religious forces around the same time that we might not really understand today. I think maybe like when people watch the news and they hear about like sectarian violence in Iraq, and then you realize that these are just two different sects of the same religion, and the disagreement that they have that has them at odds, that has them killing each other, is like seems like maybe even pretty arbitrary or, at least kind of small. There's a lot of this going on in academia, maybe more substantial as far as the religious disagreements are concerned. But there's an author named Sam Blumenfeld, B-L-U-M-E-N-F-E-L-D, who's done a lot of good work on this subject. And academia in the United States, really prior to the 19th century, was controlled by the Calvinists. Calvinists mm-hmm. had founded Harvard University in the 17th century. Mm-hmm. And essentially what they believed is, I think, an idea that is pretty common to most forms of Christianity, this idea of the Holy Trinity. I know that's definitely the case with Catholicism, and it's Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. What comes along, and this sounds so strange that this was like such a significant turning point, I think, to us in the 21st century, but around the beginning of the 1800s, universities like Harvard were basically taken over by a group called the Unitarians. Mm-hmm. And uni kind of gets rid of this Holy Trinity idea that the only really holy or divine force is God. And the Son, Jesus, is not really divine. And mm-hmm. and this is like the big split. And it's seen as kind of a liberalization of dogma. And these people manage to take over in academia. And if salvation is not going to be I'm hearing myself say this, and it sounds so silly, but this was like a huge debate and a huge turning point, you know, a couple hundred years ago. If salvation is not going to be delivered through the central figure in Christianity, which is Jesus, what eventually comes out of it is the belief that it's going to be delivered by earthly forces, by the guidance of the wise on earth, and it's going to be done through intellectuals, through academics, and essentially through the state. I mean, that in short is the result of the shift at places like Harvard University from Calvinism to Unitarianism, that salvation would be delivered through an enlightened population, and the responsibility for that enlightenment would be in the hands of the government. And this is really what I believe opened the door to the embrace of this Prussian system that that I mentioned at the beginning of this talk. But I'll pause there just if you have any questions. Obviously, the Prussian system, the implementation of the Prussian system is very important. But if you have any questions about what I've talked about so far.
Yeah, it's valuable. And two things occur to me.
Sure.
One is, have you read the book, The Messianic Character of American Education by R.J. Rushdoony?
I have not.
So I have not either. It's on my reading list,
mm-hmm.
and it's freely available. It's freely available online. So he comes from a Christian perspective, and he talks about the basically exactly what you said, the messianic, the idea that education is the religion of the day. And what's interesting when you get into talking about religion and talking about the impact of religion on our society. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, you say that you're an atheist, right? So you're coming from a very non-religious perspective.
Yeah, I'm coming from a very non-religious perspective.
Right. And so I come from a very I don't like the word religious because I'm actually far out of the mainstream, but I come from a very I'll use the word religious.
Mm-hmm.
I come from a very Christian religious perspective. And so it's very important to me, and I have some pretty strong opinions on it. What's interesting though, and Rushdoony as well, he comes at it from an extremely Christian perspective. So what's interesting to me is that in this conversation, lest anybody think that it's a matter of one side versus the other, all the history that you've just shared is all the history that I have found as well. And yet you're coming at it from the perspective of an atheist, and I'm coming at it from the perspective of a devout Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And it's dramatic how this is what fascinates me, is that we can both recognize the course of facts that take over. I don't think you can understand history without understanding even the history of religion, because it's such a dramatic factor of control in societies. And you go back and you start studying the history of religion. Even today, you look at Christian denominations, and you look at, as you said, I don't understand the conflicts in Islam, between the different sects of Islam. I have not studied it enough to even have a hint of understanding on it. But I look, and you trace the course of conflict between various Christian denominations as the priests and the religious people took over, and then this denomination against that. And you can't, if you don't understand that, you can't understand the history of the United States, or frankly, the world. So That is just I wanted to comment on that, because if anyone is concerned about, oftentimes in our society, we're so polarized with an inability to have a discussion going back and forth about history, that immediately we start to say, well, that can't possibly be true. No, it is true.
Yeah.
And the religious control over society is amazing. So keep going.
Yeah, absolutely. I have this running joke on my show where I call the British the idiots of history, because every time they go somewhere, basically something bad happens. And, almost like this, like they're this Mr. Bean character. And obviously that's a gross simplification. Sure. And it's not representative of how I really think we need to look at history, which is, to some extent, we have to be willing, even though it's hard and frustrating at times, to examine people in the context of their times.
Right.
And most people who lived will, if we look at them through the lens of the 21st century and what we know and what most of us believe, they will look completely insane. But, to understand the importance, the weight that this carried in academia at the beginning of the 1800s, I think is very, very important, and it humanizes people as well. Mm-hmm. Because it's very easy to say, oh, these jerks, they found this cruel schooling system in Central Europe that, five generations later would be the Third Reich, and they brought it to America, and either, that's just a terrible, irresponsible lack of foresight or an evil plan. And obviously, it's way more nuanced than that. So to move into the Prussian connection here, one of the people most responsible for the implementation of the Prussian system in the United States in the 19th century was Horace Mann, who was a Unitarian. And I think it's worth talking a little bit for people who are totally unfamiliar before we get into that, just inserting a brief Prussian history. Obviously, in the late 1700s and early 1800s, Central and Western and Eastern Europe, very messy place politically. A lot of, perpetually changing borders. Prussia is a very militaristic kingdom. It's been called, Gatto mentions this in the Underground History, people refer to it as an army with a country, essentially. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to give you some idea of what Prussian society is like. And they're looking to expand west, and as they're doing this, unfortunately for them, they run into a guy who has a pretty good reputation for, military competence, named Napoleon in France, and he kind of beats them back, I think, like right in the first decade of the 1800s. It's something called the Battle of Jena. Mm-hmm. The Prussians, who were not new to this kind of militarism or expansionism then, their intellectuals, their government officials are obviously very frustrated and confused, especially considering the resources they've made available to, military conquest or expansion of the kingdom. The loss to Napoleon, the embarrassing loss to Napoleon, basically triggers something called the Prussian Reform Movement, where over the course of the next decade, intellectuals and academics and philosophers like Johann Gottlieb Fichte are essentially looking for ways to restructure society. And one of the best ways they have is the setting up of a compulsion schooling system. And it was tiered, like there was obviously a private level for a very small percentage of the population. I haven't mastered the pronunciation of this yet, but it was called Akademienschulen, which was, very small portion. And these were children of government officials or, the elite in society. There was another level called Realschulen, which essentially translates to real school. It was for basically the people who were categorized into being the future managers of society. Mm-hmm. And then at the bottom, which is where over 90% of people wound up, the Volksschulen, which was the people's place or the people's school. Obviously, the curriculum in each setting was different. And the common school, the Volksschulen, was essentially obedience, the idea of nationalism, military discipline, collectivism. Would have been taught there, the importance of the state above all, loyalty, duty, Those were the lessons. And the schools were not terribly academic. There wasn't a lot of reading. The teacher was certainly the star of the academic experience. It wasn't very student-centered. But, you know, American educators were really just fascinated by this system, and they started going there to see it, like, basically right when it started in 1819, 1819, and they started sending back these favorable reports, you know. So, and then, you know, the French sent their government officials to go and look at it, and they sent favorable reports. And this went on for a couple of decades until Horace Mann went there to Prussia in the 1840s, and he came back and presented to the board, the education board in Massachusetts, his seventh annual report on education, and a lot of it had to do with the Prussian system of education. Through this and through other efforts, he was basically able to persuade other people who were looking to modernize and expand public schooling in America. Mann was very involved in the Whig Party and was able to get a lot of his politician friends to legislate tax-supported elementary education. And it was pretty much established in Massachusetts by the 1850s, along with something that they called normal schools, which later became known as teacher colleges. And normal just in the sense that they were to train teachers in social and educational norms. Once this was set up, it spread around the rest of the country, especially the Northeast, very quickly. What's interesting is, and this is kind of like one of the wild cards of history, like how successful the adoption in Massachusetts was and how quickly it spread around the rest of the country. It was all pretty much based on Horace Mann's report, even though there were reports prior to that, and Mann went to Prussia and observed the schools when they were not in session.
Really?
So he didn't really see the function of the compulsion school system in Prussia.
Wow.
He kind of just imagined it. I think people were basically touring Europe, you know, the more established countries of Europe. The United States at the time was like less than 80 years old. Mm-hmm. So obviously, what are they doing in France? What do they do in Great Britain? What do they do in Central Europe? Maybe what do they even do in Eastern Europe? Mann was like very turned off by the British class system, and really saw, you know, that's when he heard about the German system, he was very hopeful about it. And I think he had read the reports that had been written by another American who went like 20 years earlier, named John Griscom. And a French guy who went shortly before he did, named Victor Cousin. So all these reports, and actually, if you go to Internet Archive, you can read these reports. Grab yourself a copy of The Underground History of American Education. And when you find a book in there, when Gatto, John Taylor Gatto, just for those who don't know, a very famous public schooling critic who was active from the time he retired up until about 2 years ago when he became ill, wrote this massive textbook, college textbook size book called The Underground History of American Education, where he basically compiles all his research and he looks at the development of the schools from a variety of different angles. So it's a jumping off point for deeper research if people want to do it. But for most people, just reading that book would be a sufficient exploration into the history and the mission of public school in America. So, yeah, Mann goes, he looks at empty schools. And I mean, I guess he could have interviewed people, which he probably did. So he got kind of this top down view, right? It's like basically if I went into a school today, probably would walk out with different stories depending on who I talked to, right? If I talked to the principal, that would probably be the least accurate representation of what the school environment is actually like. Maybe if I talked to the teachers, I'd get a slightly more accurate representation. But if I really wanted the most authentic experience, you know, without actually having to be a student or a teacher in the school myself, I'd probably want to talk to the students, right? Those would probably be the people who would be most honest with me about
the— And you would need a big cross sampling of the students, because speaking with the class valedictorian who excels in the environment would be very different than speaking to the student who you know, dropped out 2 years ago because of social reasons or because of academic reasons, or the one that's just struggling just to pass and get through, like depending on that's, I mean, that's the key, is what happens is we all put our experiences of school onto the system. So I did well academically in school. Academics has always been easy for me. So although I had, you know, certainly a learning process of you know, as far around other aspects of life and the social environment, successfully navigating social relationships with in the same way that we all do, academics always came well to me. So I thrived in a structured, formal environment, and yet many didn't. So you would need to really, many don't. And that affects the rest of their life. And so you need a, you would need a broad cross sampling of the students to even approach getting an accurate accounting of it.
I totally agree with you. And Mann, on the other hand, in his tour of the Prussian schools, might have, you know, interviewed a schoolmaster during his summer vacation.
Not exactly a good barometer for a wide experience, that's for sure.
Right. And he kind of, for some reason, and I really don't know why this was, but he had this fantasy about what he wanted the schools to be. And obviously, there was this attitude in America at the time, a growing attitude. And obviously, through the rest of the 19th century, this attitude really expanded and became more of an urgent cry, is that they're worried about immigration into the United States. And they were worried about the diluting of, you know, maybe a certain culture or a set of values. And this was, even though this would accelerate and really spin out of control later, they really wanted to use the schools as a way to standardize society. And from what Mann knew about Prussia before he went, the information that was available at the time, you know, 1830s, 1840s, so they're really good at doing that. You know, there was really very few ways out of the Volksschulen, you know, the common school, if that's the school to which a person was relegated. So they like that idea of standardization and control. I mean, a lot of the setup of the common schools was to teach, like I said before, obedience and military discipline. But Mann, in the seventh annual report, he has some interesting statements, right? And one of them, I'm working on a video right now, so I have a screenshot of this, like, right here. He writes, in an effort to defend or explain the system and address some of the objections, he says, "The question is sometimes asked, why, with such a wide-extended and energetic machinery for public education, the Prussians, as a people, do not rise more rapidly in the scale of civilization, why the mechanical and useful arts remain among them in such a half-barbarous condition, why the people are so sluggish and unenterprising in their character, and finally, why certain national vices are not yet extirpated." Now, that should be, for people like us, that should be an easy question to answer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
right.
Why, if they have so much school, do they suck so bad? You know, like that kind of, that's basically what he's asking. And it's a question that answers itself. And it's because school is compulsory, right? What are they being robbed of? You know, individuality, volition, all of those things that, you know, I think work to make people great. Obviously, there's a tremendous amount of regimentation in society outside of school. So then he attempts to answer that question, right? And this is really a harbinger. Things to come in American schooling, contained in basically a one-sentence answer. He says, "These questions may readily be answered. First, it is a great defect in the people's schools of Prussia that the children leave them at so early an age." Right?
Wow.
So what he's saying is they just need more of it. And this is a theme that it continues up until Barack Obama and Arne Duncan. You know, like the problem is, it's not working. And it's just because it doesn't cost enough and we're not giving or forcing enough of it on the young people of today.
What's startling about the statements, and I want to tie it into modern day.
Sure.
And because, and I want to keep going with the history, but when I first started thinking about some of these things. It continues to be a very long process for me, and which is why I'm having you on to kind of discuss it, because I don't feel capable of giving the subject any kind of justice, you know, as a teacher on it, because I'm a student of it. Mm-hmm. But what really happens is that in my experience, just being in the mainstream culture, is that I was trained by culture to think it's us versus them and we're right and they're wrong.
Okay.
And this was not a heavy influence in my family, but this was a heavy influence in just in our society and in politics. And so what I observed is, for example, I'm a recovering Republican. Mm-hmm. And so I graduated from high school in 2003. So I really liked George Bush, and I got completely, when we invaded Iraq after 9/11, I was in ninth grade in 9/11. And, you know, think about it from a ninth grade perspective, and you look at it and you say, wow, we got to go do this. And I'm ashamed to say, I was emphatically in favor of, like, hey, we got to go and get, you know, these terrorists. Mm-hmm. And then what happened is I went and campaigned. I knocked on doors when I was in college for George Bush's second election. And so what happened, though, is that when you are connected to a person, then you associate the person with all the good things. And so when George Bush says we need to, you know, increase public school standards and we need to pass No Child Left Behind, like, yeah, we need to increase public, you know, government school standards and we need to pass No Child Left Behind because all these crazy teachers are doing these things without standards. And then you got the flip to Barack Obama. And so then Barack Obama, I would watch a lot of his speeches, and there were, you know, many things he would say that I liked. And then I just looked and I'm like, but this guy is horrible. But then when I watched him doing all of the exact same things that George Bush did, mm-hmm. and my Republican friends disagree with me, and my Democratic friends disagree with me, it's basically like my communist friends that, like, agree with me, and my libertarian friends. So you've got, you know, I'm out in the lonely boonies when it comes to political thought. But when I noticed that basically all of the same things happen. So, you know, George Bush passes No Child Left Behind, and Barack Obama, you know, Common Core.
Yeah.
And you look at it and you say, wait a second, I thought there was supposed to be a difference here. And yet they're both doing the same wars and continuing the same wars. And the both of them are continuing the same, like, focus. And so that was a big influence on me trying to figure out, why is it that these political parties seem to, like, they say they're different, but you look at their actual actions and they're doing the same thing. And But when I go back to it, and this, that was a long kind of setup for a question, and feel free to comment and answer the question. But when I go back, the immediate thing that I want to do is I want to go back and I want to ascribe blame. And the scariest statement to me in the world was in the preamble or the prologue or whatever it was in Gatto's book in Underground History. It was when he says, if you think this is a conspiracy as defined by one person or multiple people of doing it, you would be wrong. And what's worse is that would actually be better. Because it's not so much in what he said, and I still struggle to figure out how this works, but he says it's not so much that there is a conspiracy of this group of people, this one individual group of people, but rather there is an entrenchment of thought that is so entrenched, and I'm paraphrasing because I don't have it in front of me, but he says there's an entrenchment of thought that's so entrenched, and that's why it's even worse than if there were a conspiracy. And so the question, and feel free to comment on the political connection, but also the question is, the people at that time, do you have any sense of their motives? Because my guess is that they felt strongly, Horace Mann or whatever, and if I'm wrong, let me know, because I haven't been able to find this, but my guess is that they probably felt very strongly about their motives, and their motives, they perceived them to be true and in the best interest of people. Have you gotten a sense of the motives by reading their works of that time?
Yeah. I mean, I've combed through a lot of these books, and you're never going to find that gotcha moment, you know, like you really have to read carefully, whether we're talking about, you know, this phase of development of public schooling in America or the later, and I would say even the most more important phase where the progressives took it over. It's easy to look back knowing what I know now and certainly see it as evil and see it as, you know, just a terrible misestimation of what the role of government should be and the power that government should have and the power that academics should have and the right that academics think they have to decide what's good for other people. And obviously a lot of that is very prevalent, you know, mm-hmm. in American political discourse today. But yeah, it seems like there are times where people do seem to be kind of hiding in the shadows. depending on who you're talking about, right? Because it's like, oh, the people will be outraged by this. And, right. and you know, it's true, too. I forget, what was it called? The Separation of School and State. Are you familiar with that? It was written by a guy named Sheldon Richman.
No, I haven't read that. Is that a book?
Well, they were learning pretty quickly, right? Because in 1852, Richman reports in this piece called Separating School and State, How to Liberate American Families. The first compulsory schooling laws were put into effect in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And something like 4 out of 5 people resisted the new law. And I think it was decades later that in parts of Massachusetts, the militia was actually needed to mm-hmm. get people mm-hmm. to basically surrender to the system. So that can be summed up as like, oh, the rabble, oh, these people, they don't even know what's good for them like we do in at Columbia University and Harvard.
Right. Right.
But no one says, I have an awesome evil plan. You know, that's never really uttered. You know, and it's funny, too, like a minute ago, we're talking about George Bush and Barack Obama and all the education legislation of the past 15 or 20 years, all the way really back to Clinton. A lot of the people who were supporting those things, they sounded a lot like Horace Mann did in the 1850s. He was describing this great urgency to, you know, all of these initiatives. And like what we really need is standardization for teachers, and we really need a national curriculum and standards. And that was all covered. You know, 150 years later by No Child Left Behind and Common Core. And then there's, you know, Head Start, Race to the Top, Goals 2000. All of those efforts that are sold to the American people as making public education better are really, I think, the same thing that people have been trying to do for more than a century, and that is to standardize and better systematize the schools to meet the needs of the powerful in a changing world. And, you know, maybe it started because Horace Mann was, you know, he might have had his own religious motivations. There might have been some general fears about immigration and changing culture. It very quickly shifted to industrial needs, you know, how to turn people into good workers. You know, by the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, and, you know, everything that I've talked about so far regarding the establishment of the Prussian system really just constitutes this apparently unbreakable foundation of American public school, right?
Right.
So, like, all reform discussions to me are so futile because no one is ever talking about striking the root, which is, I mean, there's actually multiple things that could be considered the root here. You know, a system funded by force, a system funded through taxation. That's a system that you can't opt out of. That's one way to ensure a lack of quality, right? Not giving people the option as to whether or not they want to pay for it. But the real root is the Prussian system, right? A system too efficient to be questioned, but the building on this anti-freedom, anti-individualism, really anti-education schooling system continues under the guise of reform, right? It's mm-hmm. always under the guise of reform, but by the time we get to, you know, the 1900s, we have a whole new group that is going to take over American public schooling.
Let's go there. What happens next?
So these are the progressives, right? And this is all happening during a time that's often referred to as the progressive era. And one of the biggest reformers is a guy named John Dewey. Mm-hmm. And so these are people who...
You have the Dewey Decimal System, right?
Is that John Dewey?
I'll Google it. I thought it was. I was going to ask you because I've always thought it was, but I'm not sure.
You know, somebody said that to me before, and I said, I don't know. I'll Google it. So...
You keep going, and I'll Google it while you're doing it.
Now, obviously, these are people who have much different motivations than the people who were setting up the system in America or transporting the system from Germany to America 50 years earlier. They put their faith not so much in God, but in a kind of scientific management, really in the developing field of psychology. Right. Now, obviously, a lot of the sciences that they're going to try and use at this time are largely experimental and widely misunderstood. right? Mm-hmm. So it would be like a shorthand way to describe it would be like, imagine if somebody basically announced that we're reinventing the whole school system in the United States for 2015, and it's all going to be based around quantum physics. Right.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It's like there's a potential for some messes. But these are people who kind of see the merging of science and the state as a new kind of God, a new kind of faith. You know, they're also very politically, they're largely socialist, you know, mm-hmm. and they don't have the same conceptions about evil that religious folks who had something to say about education, you know, dating all the way back to like the 1500s and Martin Luther, who said we need state schools because we're at war with the devil. They didn't see evil as having, you know, that kind of root. They saw evil rooted in things like poverty or social injustice or ignorance. And they thought those were all the things the state could remedy through the school system. That they wanted to build a kind of social or administrative utopia through public schooling. The interesting thing is that around the same time, last decade of the 1800s, first couple decades of the 1900s, industrialists, people like Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller, are also coming to understand the power of public schooling. Mm-hmm. Right. They see that this can build a standardized workforce, and they actually start funding idealists like John Dewey.
Mm-hmm.
And this is largely their power over public schooling is accomplished through tax-free foundations. Right. And they have their selected academics and politicians that essentially help push and manage their expanding training system. Mm-hmm. So this goes back to that first question, right? Does public school work? And the follow-up question is, for who?
Right.
John Dewey liked it because it created for him and people like him, like the, you know, the behaviorists, the John Watsons, the William Wundts, the B.S. Skinners, a kind of laboratory for a variety of different, you know, economic, social, or psychological experiments. And people like Rockefeller, even though, you know, the Rockefeller Education Board might not have been, you know, John Rockefeller behind the wheel the whole time calling all the shots. It obviously expanded beyond the man, John Rockefeller.
Sure.
But, you know, this is the thing, right? This is where a conspiracy gets so complicated, right? Because you start to sound like a conspiracy theorist. You start to sound like a tinfoil hat person. It's like, yeah, man, right. It's the progressives right. And they're eugenics and they're all being funded by the Rockefellers. You sound like a nut, but
right. Some
of it's true. I mean, John Dewey was teaching at Columbia University. He worked at the Teachers College there, and that institution was heavily endowed by Rockefeller. And it was around 1920, early 1920s, that using Rockefeller money, he set up something called the Progressive Education Association. And this was essentially used to spread this management philosophy throughout academia. And it worked, you know? And Columbia was a huge place for this, Columbia Teachers College. But the rest of academia certainly followed. So I'll pause again there for, you know, any questions or follow-ups.
So, yeah, two follow-ups. Number one is, according to Wikipedia, the Dewey Decimal System was not John Dewey. It was Melville Dewey, and mm-hmm. he published it in 1876. So I don't know if that's any relation, but it was a different person, so it wasn't John Dewey.
Okay.
And he was an educator, however, and I don't see any connection here to John Dewey. So that's good to know, because I think I've always thought that was the same Dewey, but different Dewey. I think the conspiracy thing is one of the biggest questions that I've always had, is because there's so much, in our society, we have this incredible, most of us who try to be rational and mainstream, I have this incredible like revulsion against being called a conspiracy theorist. This has become such a pejorative term, where if you are a conspiracy theorist, you automatically, you know, people mentally, we place people who, you know, into a box, and they can never get out.
Mm-hmm.
But what's remarkable is that history is shaped by conspiracy. Like all a conspiracy means is that two people or more are working together. And so people clearly work together. And, you know, every time that the United Nations meets or the globe, the G20 or the G6 or whatever, the leaders of these organizations of these countries are conspiring to, you know, in their terms, make the world a better place. So we've got to be able to use that word. But I think sometimes, like at least for me, where I found is I found that in some ways it almost doesn't matter. Is that it doesn't, the effect, the reason for the effect, I think does matter, but because it can be so complicated, if I can look at it and I can say, hey, I've got a problem and I can do something different, then I can actually make some progress and out of it. And then that, and so, you know, I kind of got caught up trying to figure out like, how does it work? And I haven't yet figured it out. So I've just kind of set that aside for myself and say, and said, I can at least see the results, and the results are fairly clear that, and I don't think they're very good. So how can I work within that and just try a different system of some sort?
Sure. And I think a lot of these things that we might look back at and call conspiracies, maybe some of the participants at the time didn't even realize, they didn't think about it like that. So, you know, instead to reference what you said about Gatto's introduction to the book, where it's worse than a conspiracy, a phrase that we've used is a philosophic corruption, right?
Interesting.
So there's this container in which all thinking is taking place, right? It's the same thing. Like I would identify pretty much as like a libertarian, right? And people say, oh, well, that's so naive, you know? Well, yeah, in this world, a world that we've inherited from complete insanity, you know, and violence, yeah. Libertarianism, trying to inject libertarian ideas through a dropper into the raging rapids of political insanity. Yeah, it's naive, right? It's something we should start talking about. Mm-hmm. But did they ever look back? You know, I mean, Dewey died maybe in the 1950s and Rockefeller maybe 10 or 15 years before Dewey. Did they even know? I don't even know if they knew each other. But, you know, just imagine them looking back saying, did we just do a conspiracy? It might not have occurred to them at the time. I believe John Dewey cared about children. And I believe that people like Rockefeller looked at humanity and said, oh, the poor things, you know, somebody needs to standardize and organize their lives for them. And Dewey had some things to say about how children should be treated and was critical in many ways of the very Prussian system that he started observing when he became an educational reformer, about how regimented it was. There's a lot of things, obviously, that I disagree with Dewey about, but I don't think he was an evil person. And I'm not sure a lot of these people who participated in something like the Rockefeller Education Board were evil people as well. I think they saw themselves as having a role, or part of that philosophic corruption could be a sense of duty, you know, to manage society, right? And whether that came from, you know, religion or some other place. I mean, a lot of these groups that have been more conspiratorial, like the Fabian Society, which was formed in Britain in the late 1800s, it seemed like they were searching for some kind of supernatural justification for what they were doing. You know, I mean, we hear lots of talk in conspiracy theory about bloodlines, right? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, we're descended from the Merovingians or something. People look for license to act out these megalomaniacal impulses, you know? Right. And, I think there is this surface good intention, maybe driven by something deeper that is unhealthy in a psychological sense. But no one ever said, in all the reading, you know, going and trying to find as many of Gatto's official sources as possible, primary sources, I've never encountered anything that read like, here's an awesome evil plan that we should implement immediately.
Right. 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 And that's what makes it tough, because we immediately look for that. And then if we don't find that, at least what I immediately looked for that, I'm like, wow, there's got to be some awful evil plan. But it really doesn't start that way. I mean, I don't think. I think there are, I mean, my guess is that, yes, there are true conspiracies, and it's beyond my knowledge and experience to discuss them, you know, intelligently. But I'm glad to hear you say that, because actually it's one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on, because I wanted to ask you the question, because I haven't been able to find it. I've just, you know, I've more traced almost a series of unfortunate events of people trying to implement their version of good by controlling other people's lives.
Yeah.
And I see this happening still today. Once you start to see it, it seems like you see it everywhere, of us trying to control other people and control other people's lives and tell other people how they should live and what they should do. And that's a kind of an involved philosophical conversation, which I would enjoy having with you. We're not have time to do it today, but I'm very interested in kind of the philosophy behind it, especially in the world we live in. But let's move on.
Sure.
Because what I'd like to do is I'd like to flip to some solutions. And I wanted to go through that history, even if it was in length. Is there anything after, before we flip to solutions and what do you do, is there anything after the progressive era that we mentioned that you feel is important just to have as context?
Well, that's really the runaway train. You know, right. I mean, that's really like the point where there's no going back. You have this strong foundation of Prussian education upon which the progressives build, you know, and obviously they're emboldened and empowered by money from tax-free foundations that really has at its root the industrialist people like Rockefeller that I mentioned, Carnegie that I mentioned. The expansion, it's just a perpetual expansion, though. I mean, there's in 1965, there's a piece of legislation called the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. So a lot of these people in academia now see this as, you know, essentially unlimited access to U.S. taxpayer money.
Right.
The Department of Education follows shortly after that in the 1970s. That's set up. Sam Blumenfeld, in one of his pieces, describes this as like the fulfillment of an 100-year dream, you know? And it's so true. I mean, what's 100 years before the setup of the Department of Education? The 1860s, the 1870s?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the period in between people like Mann and Dewey. Mann wanted it in the 1850s. Dewey and the progressives wanted it in the 19-aughts and 1910s and 1920s. They wanted that kind of overarching control over education, which was, you know, going all the way back to the Constitution, supposed to be a localized function. Even as a government function, it was never supposed to be the domain of the federal government. But it seemed like there was this impulse, and it's understandable, right? When you see the power of schooling, like, real, right. I mean, this is something that's been echoed by, you know, Lenin and Stalin, and like, give me the children at 6 for 3 years and I will make them into, you know, I can't even think of how many people have said something like that.
Right.
There's probably, I mean, I've quotes attributed to Hitler. But anyway, that idea, the power of schooling, that we will take young minds and control them and mold them. Like, who wouldn't want a piece of that?
Of course.
You know, in this container of philosophic corruption. So everybody tries to grab it. Where is it at today? I would say it's extended beyond the United States. And this idea of global citizenship, UNESCO influence or sustainable mm-hmm. development influence. And people would say there's a lot of that in Common Core. You know, that it's trying to make people basically cast away the idea that they're citizens of a nation, which is a relatively recently manufactured idea by, what was it, the 14th Amendment that we already mentioned, to mm-hmm. cast that aside and say, we're citizens of the world. You know, we are right. the children of the UN. So now the control becomes even more centralized into fewer hands over more people. And I mean, that's the nature of power. So it right. all makes sense. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the functions of my show, is just to point out this history, but of course also, I think, to transition our next subject, what people can do about it and what else is out there.